And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is not the broadcast, as in the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This is our podcast. It is a means by which I can bring to you some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And I'm delighted to do that very thing today, as we have a discussion, a conversation with Nancy Piercy, who serves as a professor of apologetics and is a scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. She is also a fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, an author of award-winning books. Some of my favorites include Total Truth and the newest book, Love Thy Body. Nancy, interesting enough, is formerly an agnostic, but now roundly regarded as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. And Nancy, it is an absolute delight to have this conversation with you today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I thoroughly enjoyed Total Truth and enjoyed reading through Love Thy Body as well. I think it's an incredible book, and we are going to use it as an offer for the month so that people who support the ministry can get this book. And as someone has well said, this is a book that not only needs to be read but mastered. It is a book that allows us to see just how far our culture has devolved and what we can do about it. I often say, Nancy, that paradigms allow us to see only what our paradigms allow us to see. We don't think so much about our paradigms as we think with our paradigms. And as Christians, we have unwittingly adopted bad paradigms. It's not just the culture, therefore, that needs to be liberated. It seems to me it's Christianity that needs to be liberated from its own cultural captivity.
Well, that's right. When we talk about these issues that I address in Love Thy Body, we're looking at moral issues like abortion, assisted suicide, homosexuality, transgenderism. And in the book, I am very concerned to help people understand the secular paradigms because so many Christians are also adopting, absorbing those paradigms without even knowing it. And in particular, I talk about the view of the body, as you might guess from the title. And I show that the secular view of the body is a very low view, that has a low view of the dignity, value, and purpose of the body, and that Christians have absorbed that as well, and that it's not biblical. And so the response I'm getting from a lot of readers is, I picked up this book because I thought I'd get some handy arguments against the secular view, and instead it's transforming me and my understanding of the body and how it relates to these moral issues. So you're right, it really hits both sides. It helps people be equipped to understand our secular culture and respond more effectively, but to do that requires also a transformation of our own thinking.
Yeah, and maybe you can expand on that a little bit, because I think it's critical for Christians to learn to think Christianly and to develop a Christian worldview. Oftentimes, we embrace other worldviews without recognizing that we have embraced the very water in which we swim, the culture in which we live.
Yeah, let's take maybe the most hot-button issue for Christians, homosexuality. Even conservative churches are dividing over this issue, and young people are having a hard time seeing what's wrong with it. And what I help people to see is that homosexuality assumes a very low view of the body. People say we should accept homosexuals because we want to be loving. If you want to be loving, you want to help them to see that the view itself is very dehumanizing and very negative. For example, here's how I would unpack that. No one really denies that biologically, physiologically, anatomically, males and females are counterparts to one another. That's just how this human sexual and reproductive system is designed. So what happens when you embrace a same-sex identity then? Well, implicitly, you're contradicting that design. Implicitly, you're saying, well, why should the structure of my body inform my identity? Why should my sexed body have any say in my moral choices? Well, that's a profoundly disrespectful view of the body. And the implication is what counts is not whether I'm biologically male or female, but just my feelings, my desires, my mind, my, you know, the non-physical part of me. So as a result, it has a very fragmenting impact on the human personality. It's self-alienating. It's alienating people from their own body. So those who defend a biblical view of sexuality are not relying on a few scattered Bible verses. What we are promoting is a teleological worldview. Teleology means it has a purpose. So we are saying that the structure of your body has a purpose and that it reflects a divine purpose. As a result, it encourages people to live in harmony with their biological sex and leads to a holistic integration of personality. So this gives us a chance to present the biblical ethic not simply in negative terms, you know, it's a sin, don't do it, thou shalt not, which is true, but it's not complete. It gives us a chance to communicate it in a positive way. We have a higher view of the body. We have a high view of the dignity and value of the body. And we are encouraging people to have a much more positive view of their body instead of the negative one implied by the homosexual narrative.
You know what I find interesting about what you just said is that in reality, there are so many people in the secular culture who presuppose that Christianity itself has a low view of the body.
Yes, in fact, I'm getting that pushback from some of my critics, and they say, wait a minute, it's Christianity that has a low view of the body and that focuses on, you know, the next world. Problem is that many Christians are out of touch with their own heritage. If you look back to when Christianity started, the early church was surrounded by world-denying philosophies like Platonism and Gnosticism. They treated the material world as a place of death, decay, and destruction. In fact, in Gnosticism, which taught that there were many levels of deity, the world was created by a very low-level deity, even an evil deity, because after all, no self-respecting God would get his hands dirty mucking about with matter. So in this context, Christianity was revolutionary. It taught that, no, it was the highest God, the supreme deity, who created this material world. And what's more, he pronounced it very good. And an even greater scandal was the incarnation, the very idea that God himself would enter the material world and take on a human body. That was totally rejected by Gnosticism. The incarnation is the ultimate affirmation of the dignity of the human body. And finally, at the end of time, is God going to scrap the material world as if he made a mistake the first time? No, the Bible teaches that he's going to renew and restore this world. He's going to create a new heavens and a new earth, which is why the Apostles' Creed affirms the resurrection of the body. This is an astonishingly high view of the physical world. There's nothing else like it in any other philosophy or religion. And so, Love Thy Body, my book, gives people the tools to go beyond a negative message and to deploy positive arguments showing that a biblical ethic is actually more appealing, more attractive, and more compelling than any secular ethic.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating when you think about what you just discussed with respect to the incarnation and the resurrection, the ascension of Jesus Christ. The Christian worldview is not Platonic. It is physical. If we would have been in the tomb when Christ rose from the dead, we would have seen dust fly off the very slab upon which he lay. So physicality is significant. And I think that relates in a real sense to what the title of your book underscores. We ought to love our body because Christ loved the body. Christ cherished the body, and we are going to be resurrected immortal, imperishable, incorruptible, but in real physical bodies, in a real physical universe.
And it also gives it tools for some of the other moral issues as well. The most obvious one is transgenderism. It's very easy there to detect the low view of the body. In arguments supporting transgenderism, the argument is that your body can be at war with your mind, that biological sex has nothing to do with your gender, that the authentic self is strictly a matter of inner feelings. So kids down to kindergarten are being taught that their bodies are irrelevant to who they are. And the implication is that the body doesn't matter, that matter does not matter. All that matters is your inner feelings. If you sense some kind of disjunction between your mind and your body, the mind wins. But why? Why should we accept such a demeaning view of the body? It's radically dehumanizing. If our bodies do not have inherent value, then that's a key part of our human identity that's being devalued. So the transgender narrative estranges people from their own body, and Christians have a wonderful opportunity here to step in and say, we have a high view of the body. We want to see what we are encouraging is integration, is a psychosexual, psychophysical identity, is a unity, and that we want to help people recover a harmony between their biological sex and their psychological experience. Again, how can we present this as anything but a very positive, very loving view?
You say that on the one hand, but the moment you, as you just mentioned, you step in and you communicate these kinds of things, the immediate pushback is that you are bigoted, you are small-minded, and as a result of bringing up subjects like this or even tackling these subjects, you're frequently being marginalized in the culture. So how do we do it? How do we communicate with gentleness and with respect and reach out to people who are reaping a Holocaust in their own lives?
Exactly. Well, let's just take another example. Abortion is still a battlefield in spite of the gains that we have made. And again, what we're saying is that we have a high view of human life. Think of how bioethicists now defend abortion. They used to say that the fetus is not fully human. And among ordinary people, you sometimes hear that still. But among professional bioethicists, that's not the argument anymore. Bioethicists defend abortion by saying, yes, the fetus is biologically human because due to genetics, DNA, there's just no argument about it anymore. So how do they justify killing a being that's a human? Well, they say it's human, but it's not a person. A person is someone with some kind of higher level cognitive functioning. As long as it's just a human, that means it can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be used for research. It can be tinkered with genetically. It can be harvested for organs. The little body parts can be sold, and then it can be thrown away with the other medical waste. What does that mean? It means that the sheer fact of being biologically human is no longer a basis for human rights, especially the most basic human right, which is not to be killed. This is a drastic devaluation of human life. And so we need to help people realize, again, we're often cast as being bigots or against women's rights or against women having the freedom to be active in culture. No, we are saying if you don't protect people because they're human, then you have no protection for any. All your other rights are lost. You can't experience and enjoy any other rights if you don't have the right not to be killed. So again, our argument is always positive, that we have a higher view of human life. We want to affirm people's human rights, and it's the secular view that is actually dehumanizing, negative, and it's destroying the basis for human rights.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You know, you're obviously a big Francis Schaeffer fan, and I remember many years ago when Francis Schaeffer was making such a big impact on our culture, he was warning people that abortion would be the watershed issue of our era. He said something to the effect that of all the subjects relating to the sanctity of life, abortion was the preeminent. It was the first and the crucial issue that had an overwhelming impact in changing attitudes towards the value of life in general. Talk about how significant this issue is, particularly in light of the fact that now people are selling body parts. You have an abortion, then you reassemble the parts, and those parts are worth money. So there's an industry that is afoot today, and yet somehow or other it is tolerated.
Well, it also shows that it's Christians now who are on the side of science. In other words, being human, if the fetus is just a piece of matter, and you know it's a product of biological evolution, and we have evolved out of the slime by blind material forces, so really the human body is just a piece of matter like any other chance configuration of matter. And then you say that at some point, that piece of matter turns into a person. And once it's a person, it has inviolable rights and cannot be killed, and it becomes a crime to kill it. What kind of transformation is that? if you ask scientifically, can you detect any sort of transformative point where the, you know, a mere human becomes a person? There's no point that can be detected objectively and empirically and scientifically. So as a result, the definition of personhood is private, non-scientific, non-empirical, subjective, and arbitrary. So it's amazing here how the tables have turned. In the past, Christians were charged as being the ones who were against science, who were imposing their religious views. And now it's very clear that the concept of personhood is, in fact, a postmodern, subjective, non-scientific concept. And it's pro-life people who are saying, wait a minute, we need scientific evidence. We need to base our morality on the scientific evidence of when life begins. After all, nobody argues about the moral worth of life until science has first established that life exists. So the pro-life arguments are the ones that start with science. And these days, it's the pro-choice, the pro-abortion arguments that are based on a subjective set of personal views and values. It's a complete, you know, this is another one of those areas where Christians need to turn the tables and show that our view is scientific. And not only does it value the human person, but it's based on objective facts.
When I hear you talk, and I want to take a little detour here and talk about you personally, because when I hear you talk, I hear Francis Schaeffer. And I know Francis Schaeffer had a tremendous impact on your life. I think, if I recall correctly, even the title of one of your great books, one of my favorites, Total Truth, actually is a moniker that came from something that Francis Schaeffer said. So I want to get into how you transition from being agnostic to being a Christian and the impact that someone like a Francis Schaeffer had, and vicariously the impact that you now can have in this particular epoch of time.
Well, yes, I was raised in a Christian home, but I started questioning my faith in high school. I went to a public high school and was getting secular ideas in all my classes, all my professors, and I started asking, just how do we know Christianity is true? That's it. A lot of people think when teenagers start asking these questions, it's because they're being rebellious. They just want to party on Friday nights. It was none of that. I literally just asked, how do we know that it's true? And I couldn't get any answers. The Christian church I went to, unfortunately, my parents, who were also Christians, didn't have any answers. I talked to a Christian university professor. I asked him, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me. I thought, that's all you have to answer? I talked to a Christian seminary dean, and I thought, well, now I'll get some answers. He's a seminary dean. All he said was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. So it was after really struggling with it and asking questions of people that I said, I guess Christianity just doesn't have any answers. And I decided that the only intellectually honest thing to do was to say, if you don't have good reasons for believing something, you shouldn't say you believe it, whether it was Christianity or anything else. So I very consciously rejected my faith about halfway through high school and started looking through the other philosophies and religions of the world that were out there and saying, I guess it's up to me to figure out which one of these is true. And so it was after several years of searching that I was in Europe already, going to school in Germany, and I came across Libri, the ministry of Francis Schaeffer, which is in Switzerland. And that was the first time I ever heard anyone, any Christian, give reasons and arguments and evidence for Christianity. And also, the first time, by that time I was deeply into philosophy, because I figured, if I can't find living people who will give me answers, maybe these dead guys, maybe these philosophers are the ones who have some answers to questions like, what is truth? And what is the meaning of life? And is there an objective foundation for morality? Are we all just, you know, what's true for me, what's true for you? So I had already read deeply in philosophy. And here was, this was at Libri, was the first time I met Christians who themselves knew enough philosophy to answer my questions. They knew enough about the isms that I was wrestling. I had already totally given into sort of moral relativism, skepticism, determinism, all kinds of isms. It seemed clear to me that if all I had was my puny little mind, obviously I could not attain objective universal truth. The very idea of that was insane. you know, it seemed obvious you had to end up with complete relativism because, you know, my individual human brain is not going to be able to find a truth that is true for all time and all places. So it was at Le Bruy that I first encountered people who could answer my questions, and I was very impressed with their answers. And it was, my conversion was primarily intellectual. They answered my questions. They shot down my secular ideas. Okay. So it was later, of course, it became much more personal as well. But it had to start with being persuaded that Christianity is really true and has answers to the questions that life raises for all of us.
Which raises the macro issue that we are always to be ready to give an answer, a reason for the hope that lies within us with gentleness and with respect. But as Christians, it seems to me that oftentimes we're microcosms of the culture rather than being change agents in the cultures. What we do is we do what pagans do. Instead of being salt and light, oftentimes we're baptized secular humanists. You point out in your book that 2/3 of all Christian men watch pornography monthly, and that includes pastors. That the divorce rate among those who identify as Christians is alarmingly high. That over 50% of evangelical millennials approve of homosexual behavior as being a moral kind of behavior. Abortion is rampant among self-identified Christian women. In other words, the point is that we are a reflection of the culture rather than being a reflection of Christ. And that seems to be the macro issue. We're not changing culture, we're reflecting culture.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's so important for Christians to know the secular views. If you don't know the secular views, you will not have a critical grid in place, and you will absorb them. We are so surrounded by secular ideas now. All of our social institutions, education, media, politics, academia, all so secularized today that if you are not intentional and conscious about knowing the secular ideas and knowing the Christian answers, you will end up absorbing the secular ideas. And that's why we have programs like yours, Hank. Apologetics is so important in terms of you know, my previous books have all been more on the how do we know Christianity is true. And this book, Love Thy Body, now takes it into the area of moral issues, euthanasia and abortion, homosexuality, and so on. Because it's in this area that Christians are now, perhaps more than any other, absorbing secular ideas. And we have to recognize, here's perhaps the best way to get a handle on it. What is the main difference between Christianity and secularism on all of these moral issues? It all comes down to origins. Where did we come from? Secular views of morality all come down to human life is a product of biological evolution. That nature itself is a product of blind material forces, and therefore there is no meaning or purpose in your body. In other words, your body is not intended to give you some idea of how you should live. It gives you no clues to who you are. You decide what you do with your body. It's just a natural resource like anything else in nature that you can use for your own purposes. You decide what's right or wrong. You decide what sexuality means to you. You decide what life means to you. In other words, when you accept evolution in science, you end up with postmodernism in morality, postmodern relativism, that moral issues are purely a matter of social construction. The construction means I decide what it means to me. So that's why the Christian view always takes into account the facts of science, whether we're talking about abortion, the facts of when life begins, whether we're talking about homosexuality and transgenderism, where we talk about the facts of human reproduction and sexuality. We are always looking at the facts of science because we believe that the universe is a product of a loving God and that the structure of our bodies reflects His loving purpose, and that we start with the scientific facts in order to understand why God gives us the morality He does in the Scripture. If you always look back at how God created us, that gives the reason for the moral teachings in Scripture. Our bodies have a moral meaning. They have a moral message. They're supposed to give us clues to who we are and how we should live. So it's this fundamental difference between, is life the product of blind material forces, or is life the product of a loving God who cares for us and wants us to live in light of how we were actually created? That's the most basic difference between the two.
I tell you something, a million lights went off in my mind as you were talking. I want to do a little deep dive on some of the things you just said. First of all, the issue of origins, how one views their origins ultimately will determine how they live their life. If you think you're a function of random chance, you arose from the primordial slime, you can live your life by a different standard than if you're created in the image of God and accountable to Him. So if you talk about apologetic issues, if you talk about the defense of the faith, you are saying, in essence, that this is not an apologetic issue. This seems to be the apologetic issue.
Because everything derives from that. I agree. Let me give you an example. There's a woman who, you'll know her. She's a well-known lesbian pagan, is how she describes herself, Camille Paglia. And in one of her books, she says, how does she defend her lesbianism? She says, on the one hand, homosexuality is not normal. It's contrary to nature. To say that all gender is a social construction is crazy, she says. No, obviously, if you look at nature, whether academic people like it or not, it is clear that in nature we are designed for male-female relationships and that procreation is the key to why are we a sexually reproducing species in the first place? Clearly, we are intended to pair bond as male and female. And then she says, but why should I care what nature intends? She says, it was not God, it was fate that gave us this flesh. And therefore, we have absolute claim to our bodies and may do with them as we see fit. That's her quote. So she acknowledges that nature has designed us to bond as male and female. But she defends her lesbianism by saying, well, nature is devoid of purpose. Nature is just natural forces. So why should I care what nature intends? I'll do what I want. It really crystallizes the difference between the secular view. If nature has no intentions or purposes, then why should we take our cues from nature? We can do with it as we see fit, as Camille Paglia puts it. Whereas if nature is a product of a loving God, then we have a reason to pay attention to what nature has clearly indicated, to the structure of our bodies. That's why we, you know, back to the title of my book, Love Thy Body. We love our bodies because they're products of God's loving creation. And therefore, we do take our cues from our body in issues like homosexuality, transgenderism, and so on.
You know, Nancy, we live in this world of cognitive dissonance. How do you get people to face the reality that their ideas are actually in conflict? And I'll just give you an example, and part of this comes from your book. You have champions of female rights, champions of women's movements worldwide. Think about someone like Melinda Gates, who seems to buy into the notion of gender fluidity all the time that she's fighting for women's rights. And that seems to underscore this cognitive dissonance. Or you write about Mary Lou Singleton of the Women's Liberation Front, who says, my entire life work is fighting for the class of people who are oppressed on the basis of their biological sex, including atrocities like forced child marriage, infanticide of baby girls, female genital mutilation. But because of the gender identity movement, it is now deemed transphobic even to label these victims women or girls. So on the one hand, you want to fight for women's rights, and rightfully so. On the other hand, you can't call women women.
Yeah, there is an interesting debate going on between the trans movement and the feminist movement. And you're right, there's In Love Thy Body, I was very grateful to be able to borrow from some feminists who are arguing that, wait a minute, the trans movement is essentially saying that gender is strictly a matter of feelings and that your body means nothing. And a lot of feminists are giving into it, you must realize. But there are feminists who are standing against it and saying, well, wait a minute. If you can't define women by their bodies, then you no longer have a basis for women's rights. We can no longer legally protect women as a class. You are now transphobic if you say breastfeeding, for example. You have to say chest feeding because that's inclusive of trans men. In other words, women, they're biologically women, but they identify as men. Or activists now say you can no longer refer to pregnant women because some trans men who are biologically female can get pregnant. Or lactating mothers. In fact, the Midwives Alliance of North America has changed their literature. They've deleted the word mother, and now they say pregnant individuals. And even kids are getting the message. When I was doing my research for Love Thy Body, I found a picture book that was called The Adventures of Tony the Tampon, and it tells young children that men as well as women are capable of menstruating because now, you know, some trans men are biologically female. So the trans movement has hit the ground running. They took a lot of their techniques from the homosexual rights movement and are applying them much more energetically. The trans movement is far more aggressive than the homosexual movement ever was. And it's creating a climate where people no longer pay any attention to your biological sex. I'm on Twitter, and I follow some of these debates. It's very eye-opening because you see trans people on Twitter saying things like, you know, my male genitals are female. You know, to have male genitals does not make you a man. I can be female. You know, my flat chest is not male. It's female. My beard is not male. It's female. And they are arguing that even if they have male bodies with all the male characteristics, those characteristics are no longer male. They must be called female. So it is amazing that George Orwell used to say, you know, whoever is in charge of the language is in charge of how a culture goes. So they are very intentionally targeting the language and obliterating the language of biological sex altogether and introducing a completely postmodern climate where you could look at somebody who's completely male in all of their characteristics and he can look you in the eye and say, no, I'm a female. Again, it's Christianity who is saying we have a higher view of the body than that. We take our identity from our bodies. We take our sense of purpose from our bodies. And it's amazing because we have centuries we've been told that Christianity is anti-sex and anti-body and has a low view of life in this world, and we've got to counter that and say, no, it's Christianity alone that has a high view of the body today.
And that kind of leads me into something that I wanted you to clarify, one of those sparks that went off in my mind. I mean, you talk about modernism and postmodernism, and a lot of people don't have a handle on what those terms mean. I mean, the sense that modernism has to do with materialism and that modernism is the ripened fruit of Darwinism, and then the consequence of modernism morphing into postmodernism and now a post-truth culture. Cash that out a little bit for us.
Right. I appreciate that question because that's going back to the influence of Francis Schaeffer, too. You know, Francis Schaeffer used to say, I think this was his most important message, actually, was that the concept of truth itself has been split in half. That people used to think that there was a natural truth, truth about the natural world, and that there's a moral truth, a truth about the moral world. And that the two are united. They're part of the same system of truth. With the rise of modern science, many people began to say, no, the only truth is what we can know empirically, scientifically. Well, what does that do to anything that you can't know through your senses, through the what you can see, hear, weigh, and measure, things like moral truths and theological truths? It was simply decided they were not truths after all. They were just personal feelings, personal opinion. Morality is just what makes you feel good. Morality is just what you approve. And so what used to be a unified system of truth was split in half. Only part of it, the empirical side, was considered really true. And the other truths, moral and theological truths, were said to be no longer truths. Those branches were lopped off the tree, so to speak, so that you only had half a tree left. And the image that Schaefer used to use was two stories in a building, where he said the lowest story now is scientific materialist truth, and the upper story has been turned into just private personal opinion, personal experience, your religious views may be, personally meaningful to you, but that doesn't mean they're true. They can be true for you and not true for me. And so, essentially, he didn't use these terms, but what he was getting at was what we now call modernism versus postmodernism. Modernism says the only thing that's true is the material world, what we can see here, weigh and measure, what we can know scientifically. Postmodernism says, no, everything's a social construction. You know, you and I both experience things differently. We come up with different ideas based especially on our race, class, gender, right? That's why these three issues have become, three of the main issues that drive the campus wars today is race, class, gender, ethnicity, and so on. So how does that play out in these moral issues? Well, it turns out the same thing is happening with moral issues, that in essence, being human is in the lower story, what Schaefer called the lower story of the house, where, yes, we can know biologically that the fetus is human from conception. DNA, genetics makes that very clear. But it doesn't achieve moral standing until it becomes a person, with personhood defined in terms of cognitive function, self-awareness, and, well, frankly, defined however the bioethicist wants to, since there's no empirical measure. Every bioethicist out there has a different definition of personhood. And therefore, it's just a social construction. It depends on their personal views and values. And its personhood is a completely postmodern sense. So there's Schaefer's postmodern word. So there's Schaefer's upper-lower story applied to abortion. In the lower story, the fetus is human. That's what we can know biologically. But because of evolution, just being human doesn't mean anything, doesn't give you moral standing, doesn't mean you warrant legal protection. No, you have to become a person. But personhood is a completely postmodern concept with no definition, and so people are now starting to argue you can abort a baby up to the moment of birth. There's the two-story view. The human being has been divided into two stories. It's very fragmenting, it's very alienating, it's very dehumanizing, and Christians can come in with a positive message that our goal is to reunite the body and person. We don't see humans as divided that way. You're human from the moment, you're human and a person from the very beginning.
Yeah, so this course raises an issue that you raise in the book. You have abortion advocates saying that if you're against abortion, in essence what you're doing is you're waging a war on women. But what you're pointing out, as I understand you, is you're pointing out that abortion actually wages war on humanity itself. Cash that out for us.
Right. If the sheer fact of being biologically human no longer guarantees the most fundamental right, the right not to be killed, that is a drastic devaluation of human life. And don't think it's going to end with the fetus. Well, it's not ending. Already we can see it's being now applied to issues of euthanasia and assisted suicide. It's just the abortion argument in reverse. So if bioethicists defend abortion by saying anyone who is not achieved a prescribed level of cognitive awareness is not a person. And they defend euthanasia by saying if you lose certain cognitive abilities, you are no longer a person, even though you are obviously still human. So at that point, you can be unplugged, your treatment can be withheld, your food and water can be discontinued, your organs can be harvested. So again, being biologically human is not enough to qualify for human rights. You have to earn the right to legal protection by exercising an arbitrary level of neocortical functioning. But this is not compassionate. People argue for assisted suicide on the basis of compassion. That's not compassion. That's exclusive. That's saying some people don't measure up. Some people don't make the cut. They are human, biologically speaking, but we're not going to call them persons and we're not going to protect them. So the pro-life position is actually inclusive. It says if you're a member of the human race, you're in. You have the dignity and status of a full member of the moral community. The moral community is what ethicists mean when they say, who are we morally responsible to take care of? everyone who's in the human race, according to pro-lifers. So here's an example, a very clear example, where the logic of abortion is now being applied to living human beings who lose a certain level of cognitive functioning. And again, every bioethicist defines personhood differently. So you can have bioethicists defining personhood, you know, somebody who just doesn't feel like they want to live anymore. In Love Thy Body, I have an example of a 70-some-year-old woman who was perfectly healthy, had loving children, had a loving partner, and just said, someday I'm going to be needing a lot of help. Someday I may lose some of my functioning. And she went to Switzerland and committed assisted suicide. So people are defining personhood in terms of sheer, well, I don't feel like I want to go on anymore. It is that elastic of a concept, because postmodern concepts are just social constructions, and therefore, however you construct it for you, that's what works for you.
What's interesting about this discussion to me is that on many levels, there's an emotion attached to it, because we live as Christians in a world in which people who support the heterosexual message are deemed not just to be mistaken, but they're thought of as being hateful. They're thought of being bigoted. They're thought of being mean-spirited. And this has real implications for what I do, for example. I do a broadcast. We broadcast into a lot of different places around the world, including Canada, for example. And in Canada now, a lot of my broadcasts are being monitored. And if I have a conversation with someone like you who is simply pointing out logical, rational facts, making comparisons of worldviews, but you bring up something like homosexuality, you bring up something like abortion or transgenderism or gender fluidity, the moment those subjects are brought up, the implication is that the person bringing them up is bringing them up because they may have a problem with it, and the fact that they have a problem with it is, well, tantamount to being a hate monger.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people think the secular moral revolution is liberating. But in reality, it's expanding the coercive power of the state. And the way it does that is by destroying pre-political rights. A pre-political right is something you have on your own. The state does not create it. The state does not confer it, but the state merely recognizes it. So take abortion. In the past, the law recognized the right to life as a pre-political right. You have it just because you're a member of the human race. The law doesn't create it. The law merely recognizes it. But the only way the state could legalize abortion was to deny the relevance of biology and declare that some people who are biologically human are not persons. So the state has claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which humans qualify for personhood. That's a huge expansion of state power. Or take marriage. In the past, the state recognized marriage as a pre-political right. It was based on the fact that humans are a sexually reproducing species. But the only way the law can treat same-sex couples the same as opposite-sex couples is to deny the relevance of biology and declare that marriage is just an emotional commitment. But there's endless varieties of emotional commitments. So the state has claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which ones qualify as marriage. That's a huge expanding of state power. Or transgenderism. It used to be thought your gender flowed naturally from your biological sex, but the only way the law can treat a trans woman who's born male the same as a biological woman is to deny the relevance of biology and declare gender to be a matter of inner feelings. And so that's why the state has begun passing policies, and corporations are passing policies, and schools are passing policies telling us whom we must call he or she. And actually, the next one will be parenthood. I have been reading articles by homosexual advocates, lawyers, who say the next step is parenthood. In the past, the state recognized parenthood as a pre-existing reality. It's something that followed upon the fact that a mother and a father have produced a child. So the law merely recognized it as a prior fact. But the only way the law can treat same-sex parents the same as heterosexual parents is to deny the relevance of biology and declare that parenthood is a state of mind toward the child. It's your feelings, your desires, your emotions, your emotional commitment. So the state is taking on itself the authority to define what a parent is and who qualifies one. In other words, you will be a parent of your children only at the permission of the state. So notice that in each case, the state has taken the postmodern approach of dismissing natural realities, dismissing biology, and substituting legal fiat. It's refusing to be held in check by respect for the created world. So the irony here is all of these ideas are sold to the public as a way of expanding your choice. But in reality, they're cutting us off from biology and handing over power to the state. So the state is, we are losing our pre-political rights, and the state is expanding exponentially.
Yeah, and in your book, Love That Body, a major theme that comes through the pages of that book is that Western culture is even now regressing into a pre-civilized condition, what you have dubbed Western de-civilization. And I want to talk about that on a number of different levels, because a lot of people look at this and say, wow, this is going to be the end of the world. All you have to do is look at the news. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that civilization has to be ending pretty soon. The Lord has to be coming back. But the truth of the matter is there have been past civilizations that were very draconian when you think about the kinds of things that were permitted. You think about Roman civilization, where you could take a little girl, and because girls weren't valued on the same level that boys, you leave that little girl laying at the feet of the statue of Nero and let that girl expire. And you could at night listen to the wail of baby girls as they were expiring. So de-civilization on the one hand, but this is not where Christians simply throw up their hands and say, everything's going to hell in a handbasket anyway. There's not a whole lot we can do about it. But this is a time to really stand, and after we've done everything to stand.
Yeah, one of the things that was really eye-opening to me when I did research for my book, Love Thy Body, was what the early church faced. As you mentioned, the Roman culture was much more debauched than I had any idea of. Men in particular had sexual access to just about anybody. The most common form of infidelity was sex with your slaves, male slaves and female slaves. Even people whose names we know, like Horace. Horace, you know, we think, okay, in your classical studies class in university, you might study people like Horace, and you don't realize that on the other hand, he was saying things like how to buy a sex slave, how to inspect your wares carefully, and, you know, if you're feeling the urge, just grab one of your sex slaves. After all, he says, I like sex that's easy and accessible. That kind of language we've totally lost sight of. We have totally lost sight of how unique Christianity was against that culture. Men had sex with their wives to have legal heirs. But other than that, it was totally acceptable for men to have mistresses, go to prostitutes, use slaves, have sex with other men. Homosexuality was rampant, not in the sense that we define it today. Today we think, oh, it's an inbuilt, you know, exclusive preference. No, back then it was just something anybody could do. It made no difference whether sex was with a woman or with a man. In fact, there were debates. There were actually debates over whether sex with a man or a woman was more pleasurable. It's the reason that Cupid was portrayed as a little boy, especially in Greek culture, you know, where pederasty was very common, which is a kind of a mentoring relationship between an older man and a younger boy, which included a sexual relationship. So when we look at what Christianity was up against, we realized how dramatically different Christianity was. When it said sex only with your wife, that in itself was a cultural revolution, that you should channel all your erotic energies and interests into one woman, had an incredible effect on elevating the status of women and of marriage and of inspiring men to value their wives. It was just astonishing what a difference Christianity made. And we don't know that anymore because Christianity so permeated Western culture that we now take it for granted. We take human rights for granted. You know, we take a high view of women for granted. Go back and look at the history. I've given some of it in Love Thy Body. You will be astonished at how world-transforming Christianity really was and how it was responsible for. And as you mentioned, children. Children did not have a high value in Roman society, especially little girls. It was very rare for a family to have more than one daughter. You know, they'd accept one daughter. But more than that, no. They would be thrown out. They would be exposed, put out, which means exposure means to be put out in nature to be killed by wild animals or by exposure to the elements. We have found under some ancient cities, the water pipes are full of bones, tiny bones of newborn babies that were just dumped down the drain, most of them girls. So again, and we're facing, and the thing is that you look at today, and we're going back to the Roman view. Apparently the Roman view is more the natural fallen human view. We are now aborting babies. We abort, in many countries, they are more likely to abort girl babies than boy babies. They're starting to have serious imbalances in the number of the sexes, too many men in places like India and China. The total disregard of any moral dimension on sexuality, the idea that sexuality is okay as long as it's consensual, which is another way of saying whatever you want it to be, and that's okay. I had an article in Fox News just this week on sex and drug parties in Silicon Valley. It turns out that Silicon Valley has just as much a problem with sexual exploitation as Hollywood or politics or the media. There's a new book out that says that the movers and shakers of the tech world, the entrepreneurs, the investors, the founders of companies, are hosting drug-fueled sex parties. And it says that the trouble is, of course, that women are the ones who lose out when they play this game because they often feel compelled to attend the parties to get ahead in their careers. But when they do join, it stalls their careers because they start to be seen as sex objects instead of respected as whole persons. And so, again, we're going back to the Roman view where there was really no moral limits on sexuality at all. And you said, okay, but how do we not become pessimists then? I think we look at some of the successes we've already made. Well, first of all, you look at the early church. The early church changed the world. Let's go back and see what they did right. And then in recent years, you know, millennials are more pro-life than their parents. Millennials now are the most pro-life generation in America. Why? Because we went beyond trying to change the laws. I mean, that's important. But we went beyond trying to change the laws and really focused on education. And millennials now don't see abortion as a matter of women's rights so much as they see it as a matter of human rights, that the baby in the womb is a human and deserves human rights. So you look at issues where Christians have had an impact like that. I think we can do the same thing with homosexuality and transgenderism. I think if we focus on teaching the worldview behind it, that we can change minds and we can change the culture.
I also hear you saying, Nancy, that as modern Christians, we need to recover an appreciation of the uniqueness of the Christian worldview. I think oftentimes we lose the sense of just how radical the Christian worldview was. Well, you mentioned women and children. It was Christ who had women as part of his inner circle. It was Christ who elevated women to complete ontological equality with men. It was women who were the first to testify to the reality of Christ's bodily resurrection. So women are esteemed in a biblical worldview, and that was radical and unique, and I think we've lost an appreciation of all of that.
You know, Christianity so permeated Western culture that today a lot of secular people take it for granted. They think it's just self-evident. And you don't really see how unique Christianity is until you compare it to other cultures, like looking at Roman culture, ancient Greek and Roman culture. Or I happen to be reading a book right now by a missionary who was in Papua New Guinea. And he said they had a very low view of women. They sometimes thought they must be a different species because they were so different from men. And when he translated the Bible, and it said, no, women were derived from men. Therefore, women are, as you put it, they have the same ontological status as men. And he said, you should have seen the transformation in this tribe in Papua New Guinea as they began to value their wives and to have a higher view of women because of the biblical message. We need to read those stories and compare Christianity with other religions and cultures and to rediscover the value of women and children and the life-transforming, culture-transforming power that Christianity really does have.
Yeah, I think of a book that you You mention In Love Thy Body, Aldous Huxley's classic novel Brave New World. It was written, I think, back in the 1930s, and it turns out not to be all that far-fetched because he depicts this tyrannical world government that treats categories like mother and father as obscene. And it seems to me we're no longer citizens of even a brave new world, but we are now citizens of a bizarre new world and bizarre new world views. But what I hear in your message is a note of optimism that we really can do what the early Christian church did. They turned a world right side up. They were willing to face the tyrant's rendish steel, the lion's gory mane, the fires of a thousand deaths, because they believed in the bodily resurrection of Christ. They knew that they too would rise immortal, imperishable, incorruptible. And as a result of that, they put their lives on the line. And it is that kind of courage that is needed in today's world.
Yeah, going back to where you started with Aldous Huxley and the idea of mother and father actually being obscene terms, this is where we are heading. Many of our feminist legal theories and secular legal theories are now calling for redefining the family in terms of contract, getting rid of terms like mother and father, getting rid of the term marriage. I do quote in Love of the Body, I quote a very internationally renowned legal theorist. Her name is Martha Feinman, and she has a book called The Autonomy Myth. And she calls for the abolition of marriage as a legal category and wants to replace the words husband and wife with gender-free terms, sexual affiliate. And she wants to replace the term family with state-subsidized caretaker-slash-dependent relationships. Now, that seems a little extreme, but that is really the cutting edge where a lot of sociologists and legal theorists are today. Another example was... You probably know some of these names because you read them in the news. There's a British sociologist named Anthony Giddens who's often quoted in the news, who says that marriage and family should require separate contracts so that each individual parent signs a contract with each individual child. So what is the difference between a contract and our normal understanding of the family? Well, a contract is a limited exchange of goods and services. And what's really defining about it is that we decide what goes into it. Think of a contract with your phone company, you know, a contract with your mortgage lender. Think of all of the contracts we have. All of them say, okay, here's the conditions under which we will give you such and such a service, goods or services, and you will give us such and such money, right? And it's a limited exchange. That's the model that many people want to change the family to, is that a family should become a matter of contracts where we decide what we want to put into it and we decide when we get out of it. So it is essentially a way of saying it's denying the body again. That's why it's in my book, Love Thy Body. Once again, it's denying the value of body and biological bonds. Biological bonds, as God created them, are not contracts. It's a status. When you become a parent, this is not a contract where if my kid doesn't live up to the terms of the contract, he's out. No, it's a status. I'm a mother. I'm a father. That's forever. When I get married, it's a status. I'm a husband. I'm a wife. That's forever. We don't say, well, if you don't live up to my contract, you're out. We don't agree to perform a service. We acquire a status. And that's the same as our relationship with God. We become a child of God. It's a status. It's not a contract, and it's a model for how we organize our families. It's a model for a husband and wife, parent and child, and so on. We don't provide a product. We pledge ourselves. It's not limited in duration. It's forever. We don't define our own terms. God defines the terms for marriage and family, which is expressed in the moral law. So this is what we're losing today as modern people start to say, well, the family should just be a contract. That will give us a lot more liberty because then we choose to enter into it, we choose the terms, we choose what we want to put into it, and we choose what we want to get out of it. That's the mentality that many people have today, even in the church. You will find so many people in the church, when they start contemplating divorce, what do they say? God wants me to be happy. If I'm not happy in this relationship, I can get out, and God's okay with that. They redefine marriage as a contract, even if they don't know that, and even if they don't use that term. They have, like you said earlier, they've absorbed a secular view of the family as a contract instead of the biblical view that acknowledges that the biological bonds that God has created in the family are intended to mirror our relationship with God, which is not a contract, which changes our, it's constituent of who we really are. It becomes part of who we are, and we can't just get out of it like a contract. So this whole person commitment is what we're losing when we redefine relationships as contracts. And our, that's a reason why our relationships are becoming fragile, self-interested, easily broken, and people are becoming isolated and lonely. So we need to recover the biblical notion of marriage and family, as well as these other issues that we've talked about in terms of the role of the body in transgenderism, homosexuality, abortion, also the family itself.
You think about the sexual revolution. I think it was Aldous Huxley, it could have been Thomas Huxley, I don't remember who said this, but he said that people rapidly gravitated to the theory of evolution because the theory of a creator God interfered with our sexual mores. And so we rationalized him out of existence, and he became to us nothing more than the faint and disappearing smile of the Cheshire Cat and Alice in Wonderland. The sexual revolution that followed on the heels of the Darwinian paradigm, that sexual revolution had harbingers, and one of the greatest warning signs to me is no-fault divorce. And I think that falls in line with what you're talking about in terms of the way in which we view a relationship between a man and a woman in marriage.
Yeah, I like the way that you reconnected again to our view of where did we come from. There was a recent New Yorker article, and it put it in very striking terms. It said, this is the loyalty oath of modernity, the loyalty oath that you're supposed to take if you're a modern person. And that oath is, I quote, nature is without conscious design, and the emergence of Homo sapiens was without meaning or purpose. So what does that mean? What are the implications? Well, if the human body evolved without meaning or purpose, and that means sex doesn't have any meaning or purpose either. And so under all the hype about, well, we're being bold, we're being experimental, we're liberated, there actually is a fundamental despair. It's saying that sex is insignificant in a very literal sense. It has no significance. It signifies nothing. In Love Thy Body, I quote a drummer in Austin, Texas. He was quoted in Rolling Stone magazine. And he told Rolling Stone, sex is just a piece of body touching another piece of body. It is existentially meaningless. On the one hand, like Aldous Huxley said, if it's existentially meaningless, that means we can decide the meaning. We can make up our own rules. So that may seem very liberating on one hand. On the other hand, that anything goes view of sexuality is robbing our sexual lives of their depth and significance. It's deeply dehumanizing. And it's no wonder that people, many people, keep grabbing at more sexual experiences and more extreme sexual experiences while finding less genuine fulfillment. And I would say no wonder that those with power feel entitled to use other people for their own gratification, as we've been seeing in Hollywood, politics, Silicon Valley, and so on. And so as a result, Christians have a message that our culture really needs. We need to help them think through fundamental convictions. At the root of moral issues is the question, what kind of cosmos do we live in? Are we products of blind material forces? Or does the natural world reflect some kind of purpose? And behind it, a person who loves us and has a purpose for our lives. And I'm hoping people will be struck by that contrast, and that they'll be able to say, you know, I am tired of meaningless sex that treats the human body as just another piece of matter, a piece of matter touching another piece of matter, you know, existentially meaningless. I think people are hungry for a deeper sense of purpose, for something that's more fulfilling. And we're all really longing for a greater sense of significance to our lives, including our sex lives. and that Christians can propose the Christian worldview in terms that will meet people's deepest longings and make people want it to be true. That's the goal of Love Thy Body, is to help people present Christianity in such a positive way that people are drawn to it. It is a beautiful worldview. It gives beauty and meaning far beyond what any secular or any other religious worldview can give.
That's absolutely true, and I love the chapter title, I think it's chapter 4, where you use the moniker schizoid sex and point out that some might think that sexual hedonism gives sex too much importance, but the truth be told, it gives sex too little importance. And I don't think many people grasp that as part and parcel of a Christian worldview.
I love the research that I found in writing that chapter. That was a chapter on the hookup culture. And I found research from a woman named Donna Freitas. She's not a Christian, but she interviewed hundreds, maybe thousands, of students on college campuses. And she found that they hate the hookup culture. That on the one hand, they will say, of course, I love the hookup culture. They will say that this gives them greater freedom, that they can have sex with anyone they want, and it means nothing, and they can walk away from it the next day as if it never happened. That's sort of the script, the rules of the game for the hookup culture, is you're supposed to have no commitment, no emotional involvement, no exclusivity, and you're supposed to be able to walk away from it as if it never happened. And she was teaching a class, and it took about halfway through the semester before the students started having the nerve, having the courage to say, I don't really like this. And as soon as one student said it, the whole class said it. They all agreed, no, we don't really like hopping into bed with people we don't know, and sometimes people we don't even like, people that we wouldn't want to spend time with the next day. They all admitted that they wanted something more, that they wanted real romance and love and commitment, and they wanted to know people as real persons and know and be known as whole persons. And even men, we tend to think, well, men like it, right? Men are happier with this than women are. But I found plenty of evidence. I was reading articles in publications like Vanity Fair, of all places, where the young men admitted that they didn't like it either. They said it's too easy with dating apps like Tinder. They said it's become too easy. Romance is completely dead, says one 25-year-old man. And they, too, want something more. Both men and women are looking for more out of their sexual lives than what our culture currently offers. And so, again, it's an open opportunity for Christians to come in and say, let me help you figure out why you're so unhappy. You know, figure out why your sex lives are so meaningless and empty. That you've adopted a worldview that says life is meaningless and empty, and that's not the only option. There is another option out there, and it's intellectually supportable, and it will, in fact, give you a much richer, more fulfilling sexual relationships when you have them within marriage, when you have them within a fully committed relationship. You yourself will find them much more fulfilling and healthier than anything that you've been encountering, you know, living out the hookup culture as you've been doing.
You've also, though, alluded to the fact that more and more people are being drawn to impersonal sex. You know, maybe not sex with another person in an easy sort of cavalier fashion, but rather sex through an impersonal means, including pornography.
Yes, and I just saw an article on robot sex, too. There are actually brothels in Europe, and I said that in the plural because I've read about two or three of them now, brothels with sex robots, as opposed to real women. How does this fit in to the, you know, when we talked about abortion, we said there's that body-person dualism, that, you know, the fetus is human in terms of its physical makeup, but that it's not a person. Well, this was fascinating also in terms of, again, Donna Freitas with her research found that young people are saying the same thing. They are using that language. They are saying things like, people assume that there's two distinct elements in a relationship, one emotional and one sexual, and they pretend that there are clean lines between them. That's a direct quote from a student who was interviewed in Rolling Stone magazine. Other students saying things like, hookups are very scripted. You turn off everything except your body. You make yourself emotionally invulnerable. Or one senior, college senior said, it's body first, personality second. So notice in all of these quotes, these are from students, college students, and they're all saying, sex is now a matter of body, not person. So it's that same body-person dualism that you can, the idea that you can be sexually involved, you know, bodily involved with somebody, but not on a personal level. It's amazing to see that the body-person dualism, which was first detected in terms of abortion, is now filtering into all these other areas as well. The idea that somehow sex can be divorced from who I am as a whole person. And you are right. The ultimate expression of that is when you don't even have another person, is when you have when you engage in pornography or when you have sex with robots. And, Hank, I just posted on my Facebook page an article, child sex robots. Mm. Child sex robots have been invented, and there are countries now that are having to ban them. And one of our senators, I don't remember who it was, has introduced a bill to ban them here in the States. That's the next step, is child sex robots for pedophiles. So when you depersonalize sex, when you have this body-person dualism that is permeating all of our thinking, it's so ironic because, again, the early church faced that with Gnosticism. Gnosticism had a dualism that said the body doesn't matter, the physical world doesn't matter, all that matters is the spiritual. Well, we're seeing exactly the same kind of Gnosticism, if you want to call it that, that same kind of dualism that started with abortion. We're seeing it now in sexuality and all these other areas where, you know, you can be bodily involved with somebody, but not as a person. And that it's Christianity that's having to come back and say, no, we have a holistic view. We don't teach a dualism. We teach a holistic view that the body and the person cannot be divided like that, that your body has dignity and value. You cannot disassociate yourself from your body, whether it's in abortion, whether it's in sex, whether it's with pornography. You are harming, you are wronging your body. Christianity is against wronging and harming your body. Christianity is for respecting and valuing your body.
You mentioned pornography again, and I think it's so important for everybody listening in to hear you explicate the negative consequences of pornography, particularly in a culture in which it's being presented increasingly as being hip and cool.
Right. This was what was I did find this just very surprising, that young people today, the millennials, don't think pornography is serious, is a serious issue. In one survey, they said not recycling was worse than pornography. But what does pornography do? The viewer who is viewing pornography is disconnecting the woman's body from any interest in who she is as a person. And it is becoming enough of a health crisis that even secular magazines are starting to post articles. Washington Post had an article saying porn is a public health crisis. The science is now beyond dispute. And then it went into we reported on a content analysis of some of the best-selling porn films, found that 88% of the analyzed scenes contained physical aggression. And, of course, most of the victims were women. And they found that people who watch mainstream pornography are more likely to say that they would commit rape or sexual assault if they knew they wouldn't be caught. So, and why does pornography become addictive? Well, because it does release dopamine into your brain. And what happens when dopamine is released into your brain is, on the one hand, you feel better. Dopamine is a very powerful drug. But your dopamine receptors get overworked, they start shutting down. And when they shut down, you need more dopamine to get the same high, to get the same effect. That means you have to go through to more and more hardcore pornography to get the same effect. And that's why it becomes an addiction. Is that an addiction, by definition, is something that you have to take more and more of whatever it is, drug, smoking, pornography. It takes more and more to get the same effect. And I would say pornography violates Jesus saying that it's not enough that you don't commit adultery. If you're looking at a woman lustfully, you are already committing adultery in your heart. So we could translate into the modern terms by saying, you know, don't objectify women. Don't strip them of their identity as full persons. Don't reduce them to objects of your sexual lust. And pornography is literally training a generation of young people to violate Jesus' rule and to engage in depersonalized sex. And those mental habits taught by porn bleed into your real relationships. Men are starting to get married and find they cannot respond to their wives. They're so used to porn that they cannot respond to real women anymore. So it is destroying relationships. There's an organization for young people trying to explain to them why porn is bad, and their slogan is porn kills love. Mm. I think that's a good way of summarizing it. Porn kills love. It's not just bad for you, but it means it's killing your ability to love others.
You know, I listen to you speaking, and I think about your ability to concisely communicate the Christian worldview in a very intelligent way, but there are many anti-intellectual Christians who say, look, let's just preach the word or quote the word. We don't have to study worldviews, but you're saying quite the opposite. We need to understand worldviews, particularly in the epoch in which we live.
And to love thy neighbor. That's what it comes down to. Love thy neighbor. It's a matter of helping people understand the secular worldviews that are tearing our nation apart, that are tearing people apart, that is killing love, that's killing our families. To not address those, to not care enough about our neighbors. And if I may say so, it's also intelligent self-interest because it's killing our rights as well. There's a international best-selling book. It's called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And it argues that if you accept evolution, which the author does, there's no basis for human rights. And the author goes through the Declaration of Independence and its concept of inalienable rights endowed by the Creator. And he says, no such thing. Natural selection calls out the most viable variations among living things. So the key to evolutionary advance is not equality, it's difference. Created equal should be translated evolved differently. And of course, in a materialist worldview, there's no creator to endow humans with rights. There's only the blind evolutionary process. And nobody's inalienable because evolution is constantly changing. Organisms are constantly mutating. So there's no such thing as unalienable rights. So phrase by phrase, the author picks apart the claim of the Declaration of Independence. And he says, humans are merely biological organisms driven by instinct to seek pleasure, and the concept of equal rights is nothing but a Christian myth. So I would say it's love for neighbor, and it's also an intelligent self-interest. We want to protect human rights for us and for others. We want to protect a nation that defends human rights for everyone. And if you can't, I would suggest that you should be driven by love for neighbor. And if you need to, think about your own interest as well. Nobody is going to have a free society if we are not out there defending human rights. And there's no basis for human rights outside of Christianity. There's a political philosopher named Richard Rorty who died recently, and he said this very clearly. He said the very notion of universal human rights came from the Christian idea that we're all made in God's image. And then he said, of course, with Darwinism, we no longer believe that. So we no longer have a basis for human rights. And he died without solving that. He basically said, I want a nation of democracy, but I have no philosophical basis for democracy, even though I know it's the best system out there. So people are looking for a basis for human rights. People are recognizing that outside of Christianity, there is no basis, and we will collapse into a culture. Look at cultures that didn't respect human rights, like the Nazis or the Soviet Union, and who built concentration camps and built death camps and built a surveillance system where everyone was spying on everyone else. We have before us, you know, clear examples from history of what happens when a culture no longer respects human rights. And so we have a basis for loving our neighbor and loving ourselves, as ourselves, in promoting the Christian basis for a society that respects human rights for everyone.
I'm going to get a lot of people mad at me if I cut this conversation short, but I'm sure I can hear them sort of saying, I want to keep listening to Nancy, so I'm going to take the brunt of everything by wrapping this conversation up. But I do want you to say one thing to girls, because you are a female apologist, a very able female apologist in a discipline that's probably more populated by men. I have 7 girls and 5 boys. I have 12 children in all, and many of my girls are very sophisticated when it comes to apologetics. And I want you to talk to women for just a few moments about the significance of being involved in a discipline that knows no gender. You can be a great apologist whether you're a man or a woman. This is not the exclusive domain of men.
Right. It is true that there are fields that are more male-dominated than others. Let me go back to love thy neighbor. Women tend to get into apologetics more out of love of neighbor. In other words, they care about people. And if you care about people, you have to know how they think. If you want to answer their questions, you have to know what their questions are. You have to be able to step inside their way of thinking so that you can see the world the way they see it, which is another way of saying you need to know their worldview. You know, so maybe someone else might look at it in more academic terms, but I look at it in terms of if you want to answer people's questions, you have to be able to anticipate their objections. You have to be able to understand how they think. If you're in public speaking, you often hear this. The most important rule of effective public speaking or teaching is know your audience. Know your audience. Know what they're interested in. Know what their questions are. Know what their objections are. And craft your message to address them, to meet them where they are. You don't leave them where they are, but you meet them where they are. And I think for me, and maybe this is more characteristic of women, they are more interested in the real live human being standing before them. You know, when I teach in my classrooms, I make it very clear that the ultimate goal is not to, you know, play around with ideas because they're interesting ideas, or play around with logic just because it's a game. But you're learning secular ideas so that ultimately you can answer the questions of that real, live, breathing human being standing next to you and present the gospel more effectively. And I think that's the message I got at LaBrie when I was a young person, with an agnostic, asking my questions of Francis Schaeffer at LaBrie. It was very clear that the whole goal of apologetics for them was to help somebody like me grasp why my secular ideas didn't work so that I would be open to the gospel and to see that the gospel answered those questions better than any other religion or worldview.
Nancy, I really appreciate you and the contribution you've made in the field of apologetics. And I love your writing. I love the simplicity. And in other words, you take complex issues and you boil them down so all of us can understand them. And I think that's part of the process of learning to master these fields so that we can make a difference in our culture. So I really deeply appreciate your work at Houston Baptist University, at the Discovery Institute, your writing. Thank you so much. You have really blessed everybody listening in the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that.
God bless you. And for everybody listening in to Hank Unplugged, remember that you can really expand the reach of this podcast by simply taking an action step. Go to iTunes and rate. When you rate and give us a 5-star rating, it makes an incredible difference in terms of the numbers of people who are reached all around the world. And just before I came into the studio today, I was listening to some of the people who are commenting on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Think about Jagger, who said, Hank really does talk to the smartest people on the planet in this podcast. I've yet to hear an episode that wasn't riveting, challenging, informative. Aaron says, if you prize your perspective as sacred, I suggest you avoid this podcast. If, on the other hand, you desire to hear a faithful witness and share in the perspective of Christians all around the globe, devour Hank Unplugged. I'm a trained pastor in the Pacific Northwest with a lot to learn from global Christians. And once again, we've brought one of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet to you. And Nancy Piercy, thanks for joining us on this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time for another episode.